Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by the late Jerry Falwell's Liberty University by freshman Senator Ted Cruz that he is running for president, and speak with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas. We will discuss the danger of underestimating this cynical opportunist whose intelligence and demagoguery could prove effective on the campaign trail. Then we will speak with American University political historian Alan Lichtman, who has studied both the American right and the presidency and is the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President, a system which has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. He joins us to discuss Ted Cruz's presidential chances. Then finally, Congressman Barney Frank, the former chair of the House Financial Services Committee, who is the co-sponsor of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, joins us to discuss his new book, Frank, and his concerns that the political left, like the Occupy movement, would rather demonstrate than engage in a political battle against the right wing who dominate American politics. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And your Senator, Ted Cruz, has become the first major candidate to announce his presidential bid for 2016. Are you proud of your hometown boy?
Let's be clear. I live in Texas, and he is a senator from Texas. But to go so far as to call him my senator, I'm not sure I want to claim ownership on this one. Texas has produced some of the most conservative politicians of the last couple of decades. And Ted Cruz takes it another step further. It's a right-wing politics that seems, in some sense, untethered from reality, except the reality of what will gather votes. We saw that in his run for the Senate. He took on the sitting Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, and he won and won convincingly. It was a very sort of shocking performance. The pandering. The kind of red meat right wing politics that Ted Cruz practices even took people in Texas by surprise.
Well, I guess in many ways he's scarier than almost anybody running because he is very intelligent, yet he is so obviously a demagogue. He's obviously throwing red meat. That's his tactic. He's done it from the floor of the Senate. He's grandstanded on the floor of the Senate, literally using the floor of the United States Senate as a fundraising base, with that phony filibuster that he did. So, and of course, he's a freshman senator running for president shamelessly. I guess Barack Obama has set that example. But nevertheless, he doesn't seem to have anything restraining him. And what I find scary about him is that he's apparently a very intelligent guy. So he knows better. He must know that what he's saying is not true. And they're the worst kind of people in politics.
Well, he is a smart guy. You know, we used to make fun of George Bush, he was from Texas also, in case anybody's forgotten. And George Bush was clearly not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Cruz does come with a very, very sharp mind. Not that Ivy League degrees mean everything, but he's from Princeton. He's competed at that level and done very well. He's not only quite a sharp person intellectually, I think, he's also rhetorically very gifted. If you look at some of his YouTube video and look past some of the crazy claims he can sometimes make, he's very good at working a crowd. He's very good at knowing an audience and playing to that audience. And as you pointed out, his so-called performance on the Senate floor is not really about legislating or governance. It's about using the Senate floor to launch this bid for the presidency. And that's reason to be scared of him. What his politics are really all about is hard to know. He is from the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, but it may be that he's even, in some sense, more reactionary than the Tea Party wing. So there's a lot to be scared of, both for what he's capable of and, in a sense, what we don't know about him.
Well, when I say he knows better, he obviously, I'm sure he must know that global warming is a reality, except he recently said, "I'm just back from New Hampshire where there's snow and ice everywhere. My view of this is simple. Debates on this should follow science and should follow data, and many of the alarmists on global warming, they have a problem because the science doesn't back them up." And that is just simply not true. The opposite is true. 99% of science backs it up.
But also remember on that point, he's like virtually every other Republican, at least the Republicans who are gunning for the presidency, because there's an assumption you can't tell the truth about global warming in the Republican Party right now. So that's an issue on which he's, let's say, routinely delusional. How about that? It's the norm in the Republican Party to be delusional about that. But I think the way he phrases it indicates, as you're pointing out, he knows perfectly well that's not the case. He's very carefully phrasing those kinds of positions to appear to be following the science, but of course he's not. And that's another indication that he's rhetorically sophisticated. He's not like George W. Bush, our last Texas president, who was clumsy rhetorically. Now, George Bush, of course, used that to say, look at me, I'm clumsy, I'm an ordinary person. Ted Cruz is playing a different game, and he's playing it from even further to the right than George W. Bush was playing. Now, that's partly just the country's gotten more right-wing. I mean, this is a Republican primary where a hard right conservative like Jeb Bush is going to be the representative of the moderate wing of the Republican Party. I mean, the terms are almost now irrelevant because they're so far skewed to the right. But, you know, I have not been following Ted Cruz very long. He only came on the scene in Texas fairly recently at the state level before the run for the senator. His previous appointment in Texas was as Solicitor General, which is, you know, the top lawyer for the state. He's moved quickly. He's exploited opportunities. And I always go back to remind people that when he won the Senate seat in Texas, he not only beat the sitting lieutenant governor, who was a very, you know, well-connected Republican political figure, but he defeated him decisively. I think it was about 57% of the vote. So he didn't just thump a traditional Republican candidate. He thumped him a couple of times over. And that's important to remember. Ted Cruz knows how to run an election. Of course, Texas is not the United States. It's a different game. But plenty of reasons to be worried.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. And we're talking about Ted Cruz, who's the first to announce his presidential run for 2016. He was born in Canada. His mother is an American. His father's a Cuban. He doesn't speak Spanish. And he made his announcement at the late Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, which is the largest, in quotes, Christian university in the world. And he made a direct appeal to the students. I believe in you. I believe in the power of millions of courageous conservatives rising up to reignite the promise of America. Of course, in going after the theocratic vote, if you like, he's got competition from Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee. But you're suggesting that he's a much more skillful orator than any of those, Robert Jensen. What about, though, this theocratic side? I don't believe he's a theocrat. I think he's just a total opportunist, Ted Cruz. But his father, who's an evangelist, is a genuine theocrat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of those things where what we don't know is the reason to be worried. I would tend to assume, as you are, that Ted Cruz is the consummate opportunist. He saw that the move he was going to make into the presidential field was going to have to capture that religious right, that evangelical Christian right. So instead of doing what most candidates do, which is, of course, announce in your home state, in your hometown, you know, building from your base, a somewhat bold move to go to Liberty University and kind of openly challenge people like Huckabee, who, of course, has always seen himself as representing that, or Santorum coming from the, you know, right-wing Catholic perspective. Will he do it? Again, it's so early in the race that, you know, we can all speculate and it doesn't mean much. But I think, you know, it's wrong to treat Cruz like some sort of sideshow circus freak. That is clearly not what he is. As I said before, just go on YouTube and look at some of his talks, and you will see that he's not the clown that tends to come out of that part of the Republican Party. It'll be interesting to see him square off against Huckabee, who I assume is the most reasonable candidate from that wing, not Santorum. And he's, Huckabee plays the good old boy from the hinterland, and Ted Cruz doesn't fit that mold. As you pointed out, he's got a kind of interesting upbringing. The Cuban father, he was born in Canada. He can't play the "I'm just a good old boy from the Ozarks" game. That doesn't work for him, and that's not what he's trying to do. He's not, again, that's a way he's very different than George W. Bush, because that was Bush's claim to fame. "I'm just an ordinary person, and I'll represent you against those, bureaucrats in Washington." Ted Cruz is kind of a consummate bureaucrat. That's his history, his identity. So he's playing some other game here, and it's hard to know what that will be. The Hispanic question is very interesting because, of course, he's not of any of the definable Hispanic populations in an electoral sense. He's not going to connect much with the Mexican-American population, for instance. It's hard to see how he's going to play that. Right now, he's not playing it at all. It's interesting that someone with his name is not highlighting the Hispanic identity. And I assume that's because he's smart enough to know it's not going to play very well, and he's going to have to find other bases from which to run in the Republican Party.
Well, I was just sort of linking the idea that he made an announcement at Liberty University and the fact that his father is a Dominionist.
Yeah, and that's where, he appears to be an opportunist. We don't want to read, or visit the sins of the father upon the son, but maybe that is part of his agenda. I don't know. If that's the case, he's going to get pushback from the more moderate wings of the Republican Party, which don't want to, ruin their electoral chances with such a divisive figure. And, people have been pointing out for a long time that what plays well in the Republican primaries doesn't play so well in the electorate. So it's a very careful dance he's going to have to do if he has a serious chance at the nomination, because that hard right theocratic identity will only take you so far, even in a very reactionary right-wing Republican Party, which is what we have today, of course.
Well, he's all for abolishing the IRS. If that's not red meat, I don't know what is. I mean, what the hell? How's a government going to run? Of course, he can always say, "We don't need government. We can just..."
Well, I think we all understand that, when people like him say, end the Fed or abolish the IRS, that's not serious. Red meat, yes. I mean, there are people who like to hear that. I even doubt that the people who like to hear it take it very seriously. As you point out, let's say you end the Fed and abolish the IRS. What do you know? It raises some certain questions about the nature of currency and funding even basic government. So those things are just kind of the fantasy of the reactionary right. Why a candidate would throw them out, given that they're kind of a loser in that sense, is kind of interesting. Again, I'm tempted to want to just kind of shrug off Ted Cruz and say anybody who's that, extreme in a sense, extremist is a term that gets thrown around a lot these days. Sometimes on my friends, some of my best friends are extremists, I suppose. But in this case, there is a kind of extreme nature to his rhetoric that I assume is thought out, that it's not, simply him popping off because he can't control himself. The one thing when you watch Ted Cruz speak is you get a sense that he's carefully crafting every word and he's thought through these rhetorical issues. So that's what leads me to assume that there's a strategy here. It doesn't mean it's going to, be a successful strategy, but there's certainly a lot of thinking behind this candidacy.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Robert Jensen, and giving us a local perspective on your, again, not yours personally, but Texas's Senator Ted Cruz.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Ted Cruz's presidential chances with someone who's correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984.
Oh, my name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there. The laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is a political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And now that Ted Cruz is the first to throw his hat in the ring in the 2016 presidential race, what are his chances?
Oh, he has two chances, slim and none. And to tell you the truth, if the Republicans nominated Ted Cruz, the Democrats would be dancing in the streets. The Republicans always love to embrace these far right-wing candidates. We saw a host of them, you know, rise and fall in 2012. We've seen them before. The Republicans almost never nominate those kinds of candidates. They tend to take candidates much more from the establishment center. It's the John McCains, the Mitt Romneys, not the Michelle Bachmans of this world that get nominated. And the reason is simple. The last time Republicans voted with their hearts and nominated someone indisputably seen as an extremist was in 1964, when they nominated Barry Goldwater, who suffered one of the worst defeats in the history of the American presidency. Truth is, you and I might not like it, but the American electorate ranges from slightly center-left to slightly center-right, and it's a very tough go for a candidate on the far right or the far left. Cruz's other problem is he's got to play leapfrog. There are lots of other strong Christian conservative candidates ahead of him. Mike Huckabee is ahead of him. Even this nut, Ben Carson, who's compared the Obama administration to Nazi Germany, a man so morally callous as not even to consider the murder of 6 million Jews, even Ben Carson is ahead of him.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the ironies is, of course, Alan Lichtman, is that that Barry Goldwater, who was cast as an extremist and might well have been back then from some of his rhetoric about bombing the Vietnamese back to the Stone Age, nevertheless, he evolved into a very reasonable politician. I don't see that ever happening with Ted Cruz. I think he's deeply cynical. Because he's throwing red meat to uneducated people, and he himself apparently is a very intelligent man.
Oh, he is a very smart man. After all, he's a Harvard graduate like myself, so I certainly could not denigrate his intelligence. I heard him speak last year at the Gridiron Dinner, the dinner of that the press corps throws for political leaders. He was the Republican speaker, and he was terrific. He was funny. He was sophisticated. He understood his audience. He is a very smart man, and I think every single word that he says is very carefully crafted. And let's not forget, he might not be aiming at 2016. He's still a very young man. He doesn't have to give up his Senate seat. And as we know from lots of experience, sometimes it takes several runs to win the nomination. Of course, John McCain had to do a couple of runs. Mitt Romney had to do a couple of runs. Presuming she runs this time, it'll be Hillary Clinton's second run for the Democratic nomination. So I really think this young man, who, as you say, is very smart, very shrewd, very calculating, has his eye on the future. He knows as well as we do that his chances to get nominated this time are almost zero. But if he builds a base, if he doesn't implode like those series of, Kane and Gingrich and Bachman and Santorum last time, doesn't implode like them, he could be a lot more viable in the future.
Well, at this point, a recent CNN poll held March 13th through 15th had Jeb Bush leading the Republican field with 16%. Followed by Scott Walker with 13%, then Rand Paul with 12%, and Ted Cruz down to 4%. I mean, there's a whole bunch of others I didn't mention. Marco Sure. Rubio, Mark Huckabee, Rick Perry, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum, Bobby Jindal, Chris Christie, Donald Trump, Lindsey Graham, and Carly Farina. So isn't it amazing that there are all these Republicans and just this one Democrat who hasn't even announced, and the Democratic base is not entirely thrilled with her, but they got to run somebody, for God's sake.
That's right. The Democratic base had better get used to Hillary Clinton. She's going to be the nominee. And as you know, one of the keys to the White House is for the party in power to avoid a big nomination struggle. And, you know, all of these pundits and consultants who make their money on campaigns want a big contested primary so they get rich. But the truth is, the last time, get this, the last time the party holding the White House survived a big incumbent party contest, and this is true whether or not the incumbent president is running, the last time was James Garfield in 1880. So if you want to lose, promote a primary contest. If you want to, have a Republican president, promote a primary contest. Otherwise, if Democrats have any brain in their head, love her or not, it's Hillary Clinton or bust.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. So, needless to say, Ted Cruz made his announcement at the late Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, which is the largest, in quotes, Christian university in the world. And he, of course, tried to appeal to these young evangelicals and he talked about the Obama administration's assault on our religious liberty, which, again, is total demagoguery because there's absolutely no evidence, as far as I can tell, in the most, religious country in the world almost.
Not a shred. It's absurd. Anyone in America can practice their religion. Obama himself is a religious man.
So, he's obviously going after the value voters. But interesting enough, Alan, the one line that got him the most applause was the crowd roared when Ted Cruz professed his support for Israel and spoke out against an emerging nuclear deal with Iran, saying, "Imagine a president who will defeat radical Islam and we will call it by its name." So what do you make of that?
Well, I'll tell you what I make of it. And I've written about this in White Protestant Nation, my book on the conservative movement. There has long been this very strange alliance between very conservative politics and politicians in Israel, like Netanyahu, and the Christian right in the United States. And the reason, believe it or not, is at least partly theological, in that many Christian evangelicals believe in the coming of the end of times, the end of the earth, the rule of the Christ, folks being raptured up to heaven and all of that, and they believe that the Jews need to be in control of Israel as a precondition for the end of times. It doesn't mean the Jews are going to survive and not be cast into hell unless they convert, and, you know, somehow that's often missed, but support for the Jewish state of Israel is very important for certain evangelicals in the United States and has been that way for a very long time.
So it's not like they love the Jews, but they just need them to trigger the end of times.
Exactly. And unless the Jews, you know, accept Jesus Christ, you know,
they don't get raptured
up. Hot place or everybody else.
Oh, where you and I will end up, in the lake
That's
of fire.
Correct.
Right.
I'm sure Ted Cruz thinks that.
Well, but, you know, I think that one of the things that seems to be happening now, and I'd be interested in your take on this, Alan, is that it seems that the Republicans, and you've got John Boehner going to Israel at the end of the month to meet with Netanyahu, and we know about, of course, Netanyahu supported Mitt Romney. He was invited by Boehner behind Obama's and the Democrats' back to speak at the Congress. The 47 Republican senators wrote that letter, an unprecedented interference in the president's prerogatives in terms of foreign policy. And there's a theory, and I was reading about it the other day in the New York Times, that there may be a strategy there between Netanyahu and the Republicans to make life difficult for Hillary, for driving a wedge between the Democratic base that are becoming a little disenchanted with Israel, and the left that already is a little disenchanted with Hillary to begin with, and the big donors to the Democrats. Do you think that's a strategy?
Oh, I absolutely think it's a strategy. And, you know, the Republicans are very smart, at least some of them, when it comes to these strategic maneuvers. But you have to understand that the American Jewish voter and the American Jewish donor responds to many, many issues other than Israel. If you look at the polls, Israel does not usually come in, you know, at the very top or even necessarily in second, third place when it comes to the issues that influence the Jewish vote in the United States. So I'm not sure about playing on Israel. They're going to get very far. And by the way, the polls also showed Netanyahu's standing in the United States actually fell after he came and made that speech before Congress. You would think having this almost unprecedented forum would burnish his image in America. In fact, it did nothing but tarnish his image because he didn't offer an alternative. Neither American Jews nor most Americans of any religious persuasion want another war in the Middle East and beyond another war in the Middle East. Netanyahu offers nothing.
And he subsequently had to reverse himself on everything he said and has just issued an apology to the Palestinians or the Arab voters in Israel. Presumably, his numbers will go down here in the United States. But as you say, you know, the Republicans are very good at strategy. They may have some wacky candidates, but they're awfully good at strategy. And they also are amazing at raising money. It shouldn't be that surprising because they've got people like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, all these sugar daddies out there.
They'll have unlimited amounts of money. Money will not be an issue for Republicans, whether for the presidency, the Senate, or the House in 2016. And it probably, at least at the presidential level, won't be an issue for the Democrats either. It's a little harder at the other levels for Democrats.
Yeah, but what does that mean then in terms of will we have similar results in 20 as we had in 2014? I mean, how do you get the Democrats out?
How do you get them
out? Because they're not thrilled with Hillary, at least the base. And
look, every party is always worried about the base, but the base comes through, and the base comes through because of a well-known phenomenon in social science called minimax regret. You want to minimize your maximum regret. And for the Democratic base, the maximum regret is the election of a Republican president, just as for the Republican base, the maximum regret is the election of a Democratic president. And leaving anything else aside, the chances are quite good that the next American president is going to shape the next 30 years of the United States Supreme Court, because so many of the justices are quite elderly. I mean, they may all live and, you know, decide to stay on, but there's a pretty good chance at least a couple of justices are going to be replaced. Remember, John Adams, second president of the United States, served 4 years. His appointee as Chief Justice, John Marshall, served more than 30 years. And even after the Federalist Party of Adams disappeared, John Marshall put Federalist policy into the Constitution. So, leaving aside anything else, the Democratic base could not be more foolhardy than to stay home and facilitate the election of a Republican president who could set the future course of the Supreme Court for the next generation.
And, of course, I'm sure a number of Democratic voters might be aware of the fact that the Republicans control the House and the Senate, and if they were to get the trifecta and control the presidency, then I think we'd all be living in the Koch brothers' America pretty quickly, wouldn't we?
Very quickly, that's right. It's only divided government that keeps things in place, such as, you know, keeps things from happening, such as draconian immigration policy, repeal of the Affordable Care Act, repeal of any kind of federal controls over financial shenanigans. You know, people should not forget there was a reason why the economy melted down in 2008. It wasn't random. It was that the cheaters and the crooks ran rampant over the American economy. And, you know, none of them really were held accountable, even though, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans had to pay for their chicanery.
So what's your thoughts in the last couple of minutes, Alan Lichtman, on whether the Democrats will get lucky with a Ted Cruz or a Scott Walker? Scott Walker, of course, is extremely divisive, and I can't imagine him being elected as the president of all America, since he's so proud of the fact that he actually said that I stood up to 100,000 people. You know, well, there are 100,000 of your own citizens, for God's sake, you know.
Not ISIS.
Yeah, and that he's the greatest moment in his political life and his political memory was Ronald Reagan firing the Patco workers. You know, I mean, it's incomprehensible that that guy could get elected, but he's number two.
I think he can get. I don't think Cruz can get nominated.
But I'm saying he could get nominated. He's in some polls he's ahead of Jeb Bush.
Yeah, he's doing very well. And you know, Jeb Bush has a lot of weaknesses. One, he's a Bush, and obviously there's Bush fatigue. Two, his brother had this certain kind of down-to-earth, folksy charm. Jeb's a clunker. He doesn't have that kind of charm and that ease with people, and he's not going to inspire anyone at all.
So do you think, though, that does that mean that Hillary Clinton could get lucky and have a...
I think she could. Yeah. I absolutely think she could in the absence of a strong establishment candidate. But again, if you're going to play the odds, you got to say the Republicans are not going to go to the extremes again. They're going to go to someone from the establishment, as they have done in the last 50 years.
Yeah, but who is that? I mean,
well, since Goldwater, it's been a
No, but I'm saying in this field, if they don't go with Jeb Bush, who do they go with?
That's a very good. I would have said Chris Christie, you know, a year ago.
Forget about it.
But forget it, as they say in New Jersey and New York. Forget about it. Right. So you know, they have a real dilemma. It's Jeb Bush or the abyss.
I see. So that's pretty much the case with the Democrats, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's Hillary Clinton or the abyss.
Okay. Well, the only thing I would caution, previous guest who's been in Texas said, don't underestimate this guy, Ted Cruz.
I don't. As I said, he's really smart. He's really shrewd. But I do think he's got his eye on a future election, not on this one.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Alan Lichtman.
My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back having a conversation with Congressman Barney Frank.
pictures are. You don't need to change.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barney Frank, who represented the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts for more than three decades and chaired the House Financial Services Committee from 2007 to 2011. He's a regular commentator on MSNBC and divides his time between a home with his husband near Portland, Maine, and his apartment in Newton, Massachusetts. And he's the author of the new book just out, Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barney Frank.
Thank you.
And, of course, the Dodd-Frank Act that bears your name has been under consistent and constant assault. And at the end of the so-called Cromnibus in the must-passed spending bill that passed just before Christmas, with a lot of Democrats reluctantly signing on, the president reluctantly signing on, my understanding that one of the provisions in that watered down the Dodd-Frank Act has allowed the big five Wall Street banks to get back into oil speculation. And is it more than a coincidence that the price of oil has shot up, even though the Saudis are keeping the price low and now down to about $42 a barrel and heading maybe to $30 a barrel?
No, I don't think that that had any near-term effect on the price of oil. And it did not let them get into speculation, into the derivative market. It let them get into it, unfortunately, with more potential backing from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation if they win. But the price of oil is now really a product of, I think, of the fundamentals. That really was so recent that they couldn't have been dealing with it. I will say this, that obviously I was not happy with that, but I do take from that some encouragement, because the outcry against that and the unhappiness with the president, who didn't willingly sign it, as you said, but still signed it, was so powerful that I am now confident that will not be repeated. You will not see any further erosion of that legislation. Until, of course, the presidential election. Now, people need to understand whether or not we maintain any degree of financial regulation of this sort is going to be determined by the presidential election. If the Republicans win, it's very clear they'll just wipe it off the books. But if the Democrats win, I believe it will stay with that one change, which I regretted. But the basic scheme is still in effect, and we can defend it.
Well, but if the Democrats lose the White House, then they are totally in the political wilderness, aren't they? I mean, my understanding is the Republican control of the House is something that's going to last for a long time because of the gerrymandering, and they seem to have a pretty solid majority in the Senate. It seems to me that the presidency is a must-win for Democrats, isn't it?
Well, it's very important. I'm not as pessimistic as you say about the Senate. The Republicans have a Senate majority now, but the way the cycles work, it is almost certain that the Democrats will pick up Senate seats next time. Whether or not the Democrats pick up enough to take back control is unclear. It may be very close, but it is certainly the case that the presidency is very important. No matter who controls Congress, you have Supreme Court nominations that will be made, and you have, you know, even if the financial reform stays in place, a president who appoints people who don't believe in it and who are prepared to just let the financial community ignore it does a lot of damage.
Well, in terms of a must-win, at least to my mind, you know, the idea that you'd have this party that's become quite radical of late, the Republicans, controlling all three branches of government, perhaps having as many as four Supreme Court justices appointed after 2016 in that four-year term, that's a pretty scary prospect, at least to me.
Very much. I hope it scares people enough so they do what is the one way we can stop that, and that is vote. We've had a problem historically where when people on the right get angry, they tend to vote. When people on the left get angry, they tend to demonstrate. Demonstrating loses out to voting. And you saw that particularly in the last congressional election when there was a much greater turnout from the right in percentage terms.
You know, we didn't lose so many seats because people voted for President Obama in 2012 and then voted Republican. We lost mostly because people who voted for Obama in 12 decided not to vote. So I hope people are listening to what you say and understanding that this is something that's going to be determined by the voters who turn out in 2016.
So what's your explanation then, Barney Frank, for why it is that only 37% of eligible voters voted in the last midterms? The Republicans seem to be able to get almost every one of their voters out, and the Democrats often fail to inspire their voters to come out, particularly in midterms.
Well, first of all, I guess I differ with this way of putting it. Voters shouldn't have to be inspired. You know, you've just stated some basic facts. I have real differences with voters who say, well, why should I vote? Why should they vote? If they were listening to you, they'd know why to vote, because what's going to happen to the Supreme Court or financial regulation or any effort to combat climate change. Beyond that, there is a socioeconomic factor. In this country, the poorer you are and the less education you have, the less likely you are to have time and energy for a lot of things unrelated to the basic needs of daily life. And voting has always been correlated with income and education. And that's one of our disadvantages. We've also had the problem that the Republicans, after 2010, succeeded in getting legislation through that makes it harder for people to vote by requiring all kinds of hurdles that they go over. And the other thing is that it's cultural. I have a constant debate with my friends on the left. Compare Occupy and the Tea Party. The Tea Party, with whom I disagree on almost every issue, some of them are encouragingly skeptical of continued American military intervention in some places, but they're very good at political organizing. They get their people to register to vote, and they vote. Occupy, on the other hand, with which I was in much greater agreement, not entire, didn't believe in that. I was talking to one woman from the Occupy movement who was a spokesperson to a certain extent, and or at least a representative of them. And I said I was disappointed there weren't any voting registration tables at Occupy. She said that's not what we're into. And part of it is that people on the left, they get very critical of the government, and that sort of comes over to, well, they're all at fault. So those are the three factors that are there, and we just need to do everything we can to overcome them.
So do you think to overcome that kind of plague on both houses syndrome, if, for example, the Supreme Court were to overturn, they've taken a second bite at the apple on killing off Obamacare, if they were overturn it, do you think that that would create a backlash? In other words, if you can't get people out to the polls just to enact their franchise, which the Founding Fathers gave them, albeit with restrictions, you know, often the default position is, you know, the other side has to screw up and do something outrageous. Is that where we stand, do you think?
Well, unfortunately, you've stated a kind of a recent political truth that people are more likely to vote because they're angry and to punish someone than to vote to reward someone, particularly now when there's a lot of unhappiness with performance. It is certainly the case that if the Supreme Court were to say that people in states which don't have exchanges couldn't get a subsidy, it would not have the effect, it would simply make health care much more expensive for millions of moderate income people in states governed by Republicans. And the logical response would be to react against the people who did that. Actually, what would happen would be the president would say, okay, amend the law and restore what we thought was the law, that they get subsidies. And if the Republicans voted no, they would vote no. So I hope that would be, well, first of all, Chris, I hope they don't do that. If they do, I hope there would be this response. But there is this problem that people are so angry that they do fall into this very damaging, erroneous plague on both the houses. This is very much a problem coming from the right wing. You said earlier, this party that's become so right wing. But once again, it kind of correlates with education and income. People who aren't very well educated, who are having trouble just keeping their lives together, don't always have the time and intellectual energy to do that kind of analysis and just get mad at everybody and say the hell with all of them.
Well, I would say that Ted Cruz, who is just declaring his run for presidency, is in fact exploiting that very ignorance that you talk about. You know, there's a sort of demagogic aspect to him. And with the help of these wealthy oligarchs like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, Do you think that over the years, it's pretty clear since Citizens United that the political landscape has changed and our politics have become infinitely more money-driven. To what extent do you think, I noticed that Linda Greenhouse, a longtime New York Times reporter on the Supreme Court, is now sort of suggesting perhaps that some of these conservative justices are political operatives in robes. Is it possible that there is a strategy there on the part of the Republicans and the conservatives on the Supreme Court, that they figure, well, the demographics are against us, so we just got to have unlimited money from the oligarchs and do what we can in terms of voter suppression to keep the Democrats in the polls? If this is true, that ought to be enough to get Democrats out, frankly.
Well, it ought to be. I would say this with regard to the Supreme Court. I think I don't believe there's a conscious motivation there, but they're very happy with the effect. And it's true. They've legalized voter suppression in the South without an outrageous decision to get rid of the Voting Rights Act and the equally outrageous notion that corporations are people and that they can you can spend money, which is bizarre, it seems to me, and nothing that was ever intended by the people who wrote the Constitution. Yeah, that's clearly what they are doing. They need money and they want to make it harder for people to vote. And as I said, all we can do is to point out the consequences of that to people. And again, I ask my friends on the left, yes, be very critical of the failures of the people who are now in power in the Republican Party, but do not let that carry over into, oh, they're all no good and none of them paying attention and you just can't trust the government, because that becomes a form of intellectual voter suppression from the left that kind of is reinforcing this legal and much worse, of course, voter suppression from the right.
Well, arguably, it's a tactic, isn't it, to discourage people to vote, to alienate them, to make it all. I mean, one of the most bizarre things about American politics is the extent to which our representatives have become telemarketers. They spend all their time raising funds, and then
in well, see, here's what I have to disagree with. We don't all do that, or they don't all do that.
Right, right.
Please, that gives into it. They're not all the same. There are people who have differences. There are people who do get forced to raise money more in the Senate than in the House. But it is important to differentiate and to make clear where the problem comes from. And it is a series of things that the right wing has been able to do. Despite that, look, we did get financial reform. We did get health care. We did repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We did make it easier for women to sue if they're discriminated against. So there is a danger, if you look only at the bleak side, that people who don't like that get depressed and say, well, what good is it? Nothing good happens. But that, again, can only be resolved by people voting.
Well, and I agree with you. And in fact, I was in Washington for the Supreme Court hearings, and I interviewed a number of really outstanding Democratic congresspeople who've stood up for the Affordable Care Act and who certainly don't spend their days telemarketing for money. But it is a huge factor. And I'm wondering now whether what's happening now with John Boehner going to meet with Netanyahu in Israel. Do you think that the Republicans have a strategy coordinated with Netanyahu to sort of drive a wedge between Democratic donors and the Democratic base that is?
Yes, I think Netanyahu is very, very clearly wants the Republicans to do better, and I think very inappropriately did that. I think it's very important for those of us on the Democratic side who also believe in Israel's right to exist. So we have to make a distinction between the Prime Minister of Israel and Israel. You know, we should be used to that. I never considered... I never identified George W. Bush with America entirely, and I think we have to be very clear that the legitimate interests of Israel and aspects of Israeli society that we support, and that's different from Netanyahu, and it is clear that with the very partisan Republican ambassador Netanyahu appointed, that there is some collaboration between Boehner and Netanyahu, and I think that, by the way, that's going to anger many Americans who are, as I said, strong supporters of Israel. In fact, I think what Netanyahu does damages Israel by identifying it with one political faction. He diminishes its overall level of support in America.
So in terms of your new book, Barney Frank, and the extent to which it contains a critique of the Democrats in the sense that I think it's fair to say that, well, we know for the record that the Republicans are doing incredibly well. They did incredibly well in the last election. And now that you see the contours of their new budget, it's clear that they're screwing a lot of the people that voted for them. And that has always, you know, progressives have always been sort of wringing their hands over the idea of why is it that Americans vote against their own interests. But on the other side, where is the Democratic narrative to make it clear that there is a choice here?
Well, again, I have to say that you're way too pessimistic. The Democrats have won four of the last six presidential elections. You make it sound as if it's been a complete rout. And in fact, for 2 years, we had control of the House and Senate. So this is a far less unequal battle than you suggest. And again, there is a danger that you kind of depress people not to working. I think the Democratic narrative has been a very strong one. I think it can get stronger because there's a flaw in it. But what the Democrats have been talking about increasingly is that if we come together through government, we can do things, financial reform, health care. And now there is an increasing emphasis by a lot of Democrats about the need to diminish inequality. And yes, I believe over the next year and a half, that will be the theme. I think you will also see now a strong defense of Medicare, Medicaid, of those programs that the Republicans are cutting. So I'm, as I said, optimistic about the 2016 election. If Ted Cruz were the nominee, I'd be ecstatic, but I'm afraid they're not quite nuts enough to nominate him. But no, I think the Democrats will defend the accomplishments in the area that we've had accomplishments, health care, financial reform, and some other things, and talk more and more about diminishing inequality. I predict you're going to see an increasing explicit Democratic affirmation of the importance of labor unions, because one of the leading Republican candidates right now, Scott Walker of Wisconsin, has made his national reputation mainly as a union buster.
Right, and he said recently that the greatest political moment in his lifetime was Ronald Reagan firing the PATCO.
Yes,
which is extraordinary.
And that makes another good point, people voting against themselves. Right. The Professional Air Traffic Controllers Union, PATCO, had endorsed Reagan. So I think, as I said, you will see strong Democratic opposition to those budgets, and we will be drawing the line very sharply between ourselves and them. And the Democrats have been supportive of a healthy private sector, but we also believe that there are great needs that you have to get in the public sector, and they will be stressed more and more.
Well, perhaps it's because I'm my pessimism may reflect that I'm with the furthest left on the American media dial is Pacifica Radio, and frankly, the network is going broke and sort of self-marginalizing. And we're always sort of told that we have a liberal media in the United States. But frankly, from where I sit, Fox News looks a hell of a lot more powerful.
Oh, I don't think that we have a liberal media at all. In fact, I think we have a media which is objectively conservative, although not intentionally. That is, the worst part of the media is the negative bias. The media plays into the hands of the anti-government people because good news is no news. Successes are not talked about. It's news when something is done wrong. The Health Care Act has had a great deal of successes. We've had real progress in constraining some abuses. For instance, the Independent Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has done very good work, but you almost never read about it. So I share your view that this notion that there's a liberal media is just wrong. And I think what you have is a media with its penchant for the negative, that is one of the factors that helps depress turnout.
Well, I was going to say earlier that the money that's raised by the Congress, almost all of it goes to the big media monopolies to buy television ads to get reelected. So the media has a vested interest in this broken political system, don't they?
Yes. By the way, there is one other, and the individual journalists, though, I don't exempt them. They seem to think they do better. Satisfy their mission better by writing negative. There is one aspect of the Democratic narrative that I think, and it's a major theme of my book. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book. Democrats, I think, are overwhelmingly in favor of the set of programs that will diminish inequality, that will help people in the middle and working classes get education and relieve their burden of their health care and provide better services. What some people are still resisting is that we're only going to be able to do that if we make a substantial reduction in American military spending. At this point, the president, who correctly said, I'm pulling out of Iraq and pulling out of Afghanistan, is getting a lot of pressure to go back in. And the single most important decision now is we have to be supportive of his doing that. Because in terms of actually being able to implement the program that I think will appeal to working class people who are alienated, that will respond to their economic needs, unfortunately, in the current climate, you can't get support for tax increases. We've got to find money that's already being spent and repurpose it. And there are two ways to do that. One, stop prosecuting people for taking marijuana and other drugs that don't hurt anybody else. And two, cut back on American military spending substantially. Stop these interventions like Iraq, which costs $1 trillion. And again, that's sort of the major theme of my book to my Democratic colleagues. I'm on the whole supportive of what we've done compared to the Republicans. But I think people have to be tougher on this question of reducing military spending.
Well, just in closing, Barney Frank, the president recently floated the idea that perhaps we should have compulsory voting like they do in a number of countries. In Australia, where you get fined if you don't vote, and 95% of people vote regularly. And the current very conservative government, led by a global warming denier, when he was running, he promised, this was his platform, full 6 months paid pregnancy leave for all Australian women and their significant others. Need to say he reneged on them. But the idea that ultra-conservative would run on such a liberal platform, I think, tells you something about what happens if everybody votes. I'm looking here at a picture of you leaning against the wall with President Obama. It's a great picture.
And, yeah, we were talking about health care at the time.
Yeah, right. And what do you think of this guy? He seems to me to be, it's tragic that he tried to reach out to the Republicans and he just got spat
no,
in the face.
No, I agree with that. Look, I think his mistake was to think it was possible. On the other hand, if he hadn't tried, I think people would have been saying, oh, you should have. It was very clear they were never going to cooperate with him. And what I think about him is that with the right Congress, he has one of the best records. Again, you look at the 2009-2010 Democratic House, Senate, and President, and you get one of the best two-year records of accomplishment. Not, obviously, everything I would like or that you might like, but significant. So I think he's been very good on the values, and he has been elected twice, which is very important. He's appointed good Supreme Court justices. He's appointed tough people to regulate. I am a little worried now. I think he was on the right track. I know he's on the right track on cutting back on military spending. I hope he can withstand this pressure. Keeping American troops indefinitely in Iraq and Afghanistan is not going to be able to solve their problems. Their problems are not military. They are internal. They are social. They are cultural. And the military can't resolve those. And if we do not begin to scale back on our military commitments, we will never have the money to do the kinds of things that are good for working people and for fairness and will help them see the value of government.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Barney Frank.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And again, I've been speaking with Barney Frank, who represented the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts for more than three decades and chaired the House Financial Services Committee from 2007 to 2011. He's a regular commentator on MSNBC and divides his time between a home with his husband near Portland, Maine, and an apartment in Newton, Massachusetts. And he's the author of the new book just out, Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.